As we traveled, the landscape grew even more jungle-like, and we saw very few signs of people. I began thinking of the eighth insight. Clearly, it was a new understanding of how to treat others, but I didn't understand it completely. Carla had told me of the way one should treat children and the dangers of an addiction to a person. But both Pablo and Carla had alluded to a way to consciously project energy onto others. What was that about? I caught Julia's eye and said, "I haven't quite grasped the eighth insight. How we approach other people determines how quickly we evolve, how quickly our life questions are answered," she said. "How does that work?" I asked. "Think about your own situation," she said. "How have your questions been answered?" "By people who came along, I guess." "Were you completely open to their messages?" "Not really. I was mainly aloof."
"Were the people who brought messages to you pulled back also?"
"No, they were very open and helpful. I hesitated, unable to think of the correct way to express my idea.
"Did they help you by opening you up?" she asked. "Did they fill you with warmth and energy somehow?"
Her remark uncapped an eruption of memories. I recalled Will's soothing attitude when I was on the verge of panic in Lima, and Sanchez's fatherly hospitality, and Father Carl's and Pablo's and Carla's concerned counsel. And now Julia's. They all had the same look in their eyes.
"Yes," I said, "all of you have done that."
"That's right," she said. "We have. And we were doing it consciously, following the eighth insight. By lifting you up and helping you to get clear, we could search for the truth, the message that you had for us. Do you understand that? Energizing you was the best thing we could do for ourselves."
"What does the manuscript say about all this, exactly?"
"It says that whenever people cross our paths, there is always a message for us. Chance encounters do not exist. But how we respond to these encounters determines whether we're able to receive the message. If we have a conversation with someone who crosses our path and we do not see a message pertaining to our current questions, it does not mean there was no message. It only means we missed it for some reason."
She thought for a moment, then continued. "Have you ever run into an old friend or acquaintance, talked for a minute and left, then run into him or her again the same day or the same week?"
"Yes, I have," I replied.
"And what do you usually say?"
"Something like, 'Well, fancy seeing you again,' and laugh and go on your way."
"Something like that."
"The manuscript says that what we should do instead in this situation is to stop what we are doing, no matter what, and find out the message we have for that person, and that the person has for us. The manuscript predicts that once humans grasp this reality, our interaction will slow down and become more purposeful and deliberate."
"But isn't that hard to do? Especially with someone who wouldn't know what you were talking about."
"Yes, but the manuscript outlines the procedures."
"You mean the exact way we're supposed to treat each other?"
"That's right."
"What does it say?"
"Do you remember the third insight, that humans are unique in a world of energy and that they can project their energy consciously?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember how this is done?"
I recalled John's lessons.
"Yes, it's done by appreciating the beauty of an object until enough energy comes into us to feel love. At that point, we can send energy back."
"That's right. And the same principle holds true with people. When we appreciate the shape and demeanor of a person, really focus on them until their shape and features begin to stand out and to have more presence, we can send them energy, lifting them up.
Of course, the first step is to keep our own energy high. Then we can start the flow of energy coming into us, through us, and into the other person.
The more we appreciate their wholeness, their inner beauty, the more the energy flows into them, and naturally, the more that flows into us."
She laughed. "It's really a rather hedonistic thing to do," she said. "The more we can love and appreciate others, the more energy flows into us. That's why loving and energizing others is the best possible thing we can do for ourselves."
I've heard that before, I said. Father Sanchez says it often. I looked at Julia closely. I had the feeling I was seeing her deeper personality for the first time. She returned my gaze for an instant, then focused again on the road. The effect on the individual of this projection of energy is immense, she said. Right now, for instance, you're filling me with energy. I can feel it. What I feel is a greater sense of lightness and clarity as I'm formulating my thoughts to speak. Because you are giving me more energy than I would have otherwise, I can see what my truth is and more readily give it to you. When I do that, you have a sense of revelation about what I'm saying. This leads you to see my higher self even more fully, and so appreciate and focus on it at an even deeper level, which gives me even more energy and greater insight into my truth, and the cycle begins over again. Two or more people doing this together can reach incredible highs as they build one another up and have it immediately returned. You must understand, though, that this connection is completely different from a codependent relationship. A codependent relationship begins this way, but soon becomes controlling because the addiction cuts them off from their source and the energy runs out. Real projection of energy has no attachment or intention. Both people are just waiting for the messages. As she spoke, I thought of a question. Pablo had said that I didn't get Father Cousteau's message at first because I set off his childhood drama. What do we do, I asked Julia, if the person we are speaking with is already operating in a control drama and trying to pull us into it? How do we cut through that? Julia answered quickly. The manuscript says if we do not assume the matching drama, then the person's own drama will fall apart. I'm not sure I understand, I said. Julia was looking at the road ahead. I could tell she was in thought. Somewhere right through here is a house where we can buy some gasoline. I looked down at the gas gauge. It indicated the truck's tank was half full. We still have plenty of gas, I said. Yes, I know, she replied. But I had a thought about stopping and filling it up, so I think we should. Oh, okay. There's the road, she said, pointing to the right. We made the turn and drove almost a mile into the jungle before arriving at what looked like a supply house for fishermen and hunters. The dwelling was built at the edge of a river and several fishing boats were tied to the dock. We pulled up to a rusty pump, and Julia went inside to find the owner. I climbed out and stretched, then walked around the building to the water's edge. The air was extremely humid. Although the thick canopy of trees blocked the sun, I could tell it was almost directly overhead. Soon, the temperature would be scorching. Suddenly, a man behind me was speaking angrily in Spanish. I turned to see a short, stocky Peruvian. He looked at me menacingly and repeated the statement. I don't understand what you're saying. He switched to English. Who are you? What are you doing here? I tried to ignore him. We're just here for gas. We'll be gone in a few minutes. I turned around and faced the water again, hoping he would go away. He walked to the side of me. I think you better tell me who you are, Yankee. I looked at him again. He appeared to be serious. I'm an American, I said. I'm not sure where I'm going. I'm riding with a friend. A lost American, he said hostily. That's right, I said. What are you after here, American? I'm not after anything, I said, trying to walk back to the car, and I've done nothing to you. Leave me alone. I noticed suddenly that Julia was standing at the vehicle. When I looked, the Peruvian turned and looked too. It's time to leave, Julia said. They're not in business any longer. Who are you? The Peruvian asked her in his hostile tone. Why are you so angry? Julia asked in response. The man's demeanor changed. Because it is my job to look after this place. I'm sure you do a good job, but it's hard for people to talk if you're frightening them. The man stared, trying to figure Julia out. We're on our way to Iquitos, Julia said. We're working with Father Sanchez and Father Carl. Do you know them? He shook his head, but the mention of the two priests settled him down even more. He finally nodded and walked away. "Let's go," Julia said. We got in the truck and drove away. I realized how anxious and nervous I had been. I tried to shake it off. "Did anything happen inside?" I asked. Julia looked at me. "What do you mean?" "I mean, did anything happen inside to explain why you had the thought to stop?" She laughed, then said, "No, all the action was outside." I looked at her. "Have you figured it out?" she asked. "No," I replied. "What were you thinking about just before we arrived?" "That I wanted to stretch my legs." "No, before that. What were you asking about when we were talking?" I tried to think. We were talking about childhood dramas. Then I remembered. "You had said something that had confused me," I said. "You had said that a person cannot play a control drama with us unless we play the matching drama. I didn't understand that." "Do you understand now?" "Not really. What are you getting at?" "The scene outside clearly demonstrated what happens if you do play the matching drama."
"How?"
She glanced at me briefly. "What drama was the man playing with you?"
"He was obviously the intimidator."
"Right. And what drama did you play?"
"I was just trying to get him off my back."
"I know, but what drama were you playing?"
"Well, I started off in my aloofness drama, but he kept coming after me."
"Then?"
The conversation was irritating me, but I tried to get centered and stay with it. I looked at Julia and said, "I guess I was playing a poor me."
She smiled. "That's right."
"I noticed you handled him with no problem," I said.
"Only because I didn't play the drama he expected. Remember that each person's control drama was formed in childhood in relation to another drama. Therefore, each drama needs a matching drama to be fully played out. What the intimidator needs in order to get energy is either a poor me or another intimidator."
"How did you handle it?" I asked, still confused.
"My drama response would have been to play the intimidator myself, trying to out-intimidate him. Of course, this would probably have resulted in violence. But instead, I did what the manuscript instructs. I named the drama he was playing. All dramas are covert strategies to get energy. He was trying to intimidate you out of your energy. When he tried that on me, I named what he was doing."
"That's why you asked why he was so angry?"
"Yes. The manuscript says that covert manipulations for energy can't exist if you bring them into consciousness by pointing them out. They cease to be covert. It is a very simple method. The best truth about what's going on in a conversation always prevails. After that, the person has to be more real and honest."
"That makes sense," I said. "I guess I've even named dramas myself before, though I didn't know what I was doing."
"I'm sure. That's something all of us have done. We're just learning more about what is at stake. And the key to making it work is to simultaneously look beyond the drama at the real person in front of you and send as much energy their way as possible. If they can feel energy coming in any way, then it's easier for them to give up their way of manipulating for it."
"What could you appreciate in that guy?" I said.
"I could appreciate him as a little insecure boy needing energy desperately. Besides, he brought you a very timely message, right?"
I looked at her. She appeared to be on the verge of laughter.
"You think we stopped there just so I could grasp how to deal with someone playing a drama?" "That was the question you asked, wasn't it?"
I smiled, my good feeling beginning to return.
"Yes, I guess it was."
A mosquito buzzing around my face forced me awake. I looked over at Julia. She was smiling as though recalling something humorous. For several hours after leaving the river camp, we had ridden in silence, munching on the food Julia had prepared for the trip. "You're awake," Julia said.
Yes, I replied. How far is Iquitos? The town is about 30 miles, but the Stewart Inn is only a few minutes ahead. It's a small inn and hunting camp. The owner is English and supports the manuscript. She smiled again. We have had many good times together. Unless something has happened, he should be there. I hope we can get a lead on where Will is. She pulled the truck to the side of the road and looked at me. We'd better get centered in where we are, she said. Before I ran into you again, I had been floundering around wanting to help find the Ninth Insight, but not knowing where to go. At one point I realized I had been thinking repeatedly of Hinton. I get to his house, and who should show up but you? And you tell me that you're looking for Will, and that he's rumored to be in Iquitos. I have the intuition that we'll both be involved in finding the Ninth Insight. And then you have the intuition that at some point we separate and go in different directions. Is that pretty much it? Yes, I said. Well, I want you to know that after that, I got to thinking about Willie Stewart and the inn. Something is going to happen there. I nodded. She drove the vehicle back on the road and around a curve. There's the inn, Julia said. Ahead about 200 yards, where the road took another sharp bend to the right, was a two-story Victorian-style home. We pulled into a gravel parking area and stopped. Several men were talking on the porch. I opened the door of the vehicle and was about to get out when Julia touched my shoulder. Remember, she said, no one is here by accident. Stay alert for the messages. I followed her as we walked up the porch. The men, well-dressed Peruvians, nodded distractedly as we walked by them and into the house. Once in the large foyer, Julia pointed to a dining room and asked me to pick a table and wait there while she looked for the owner. I surveyed the room. It contained a dozen or so tables lined in two rows. I picked a table about halfway down and sat with my back against the wall. Three more men, all Peruvians, came in behind me and sat down across from my table. Another man came in soon after and took a table about 20 feet to my right. He sat at an angle where his back was slightly toward me. I noticed he was a foreigner, perhaps European. Julia entered the room, spotted me, and then walked over and sat down facing me. The owner isn't here, she said, and his clerk knew nothing of Will. Now what? I asked. She looked at me and shrugged. I don't know. We'll have to assume that someone here has a message for us. Who do you think it is? I don't know. How do you know it will happen? I asked, suddenly feeling skeptical. Even after all the mysterious coincidences that had happened to me since I had been in Peru, I still had trouble believing one would occur just now because we wanted it to. Don't forget the third insight, Julia replied. The universe is energy. Energy that responds to our expectations. People are part of that energy universe, too. So when we have a question, the people show up who have the answer. She cut her eyes to the other people in the room. I don't know who these people are, but if we could talk with them long enough, we would find a truth each had for us, some part of the answer to our questions. I looked at her askance. She leaned toward me across the table. Get it into your head. Everyone who crosses our path has a message for us. Otherwise, they would have taken another path, or left earlier or later. The fact that these people are here means that they are here for some reason. I looked at her, still not sure whether I believed it was that simple. The hard part, she said, is figuring out who to take time to talk with when talking with everyone is impossible. How do you decide? I asked. The manuscript says there are signs. I was listening intently to Julia, but for some reason I glanced around and looked at the man to my right. He turned around at exactly the same time and looked back at me. As I caught his eye, he shifted his gaze back to his food. I also looked away. What signs? I asked. Signs like that, she said. Like what? Like what you just did. She nodded toward the man to my right. What do you mean? Julia leaned toward me again. The manuscript says we will learn that sudden, spontaneous eye contact is a sign that two people should talk.
But doesn't that happen all the time? I asked.
Yes, it does, she said. And after it happens, most people just forget about it and go on with what they are doing.
I nodded. What other signs does the manuscript mention? I asked.
A sense of recognition, she replied. Seeing someone who looks familiar, even though you know you've never seen the person before.
When she said that, I thought of Dobson and Renault, of how familiar they looked when I had first seen them.
Does the manuscript say anything about why some people look familiar? I asked.
Not much. It just says we are members of the same thought group with certain other people.
Thought groups are usually evolving along the same lines of interest. They think the same, and that creates the same expression and outward experience. We intuitively recognize members of our own thought group, and very often they provide messages for us.
I looked at the man to my right one more time. He did look vaguely familiar. Incredibly, as I gazed at him, he turned and glanced at me again. I quickly looked back at Julia.
You must talk with this man, Julia said.
I didn't respond. I felt uncomfortable with the idea of just walking up to him. I wanted to leave, to go to Iquitos. I was about to make that suggestion when Julia spoke again.
This is where we need to be, she said, not Iquitos. We have to play this out. The trouble with you is that you're resisting the idea of walking up to him and starting a conversation.
How did you do that? I asked.
Do what? She replied.
Know what I was thinking.
There is nothing mysterious about it. It's a matter of looking closely at your expressions.
What do you mean?
When you are appreciating someone at a deeper level, you can see their most honest self beyond any facades they may put up. When you really focus at this level, you can perceive what someone is thinking as a subtle expression on their face. This is perfectly natural.
It sounds telepathic to me, I said.
She grinned. Telepathy is perfectly natural.
I glanced over at the man again. He did not look.
You had better get your energy together and talk with him, Julia said, before you lose the opportunity.
I focused on increasing my energy until I felt stronger, then asked, What am I going to say to this guy?
The truth, she said. Put the truth in a form you think he would recognize.
Okay, I will. I slid back my chair and walked over to where the man was sitting. He looked shy and nervous, the way I remembered Pablo looking the night I met him. I tried to look beyond the man's nervousness to a deeper level. When I did, I seemed to perceive a new look on his face, one with more energy.
Hello, I said. You appear not to be a native Peruvian. I'm hoping you can help me. I'm looking for a friend of mine, Will James.
Please, sit down, he said in a Scandinavian accent. I'm Professor Edmund Connor. He offered me his hand and said, I'm sorry, I do not know your friend, Will. I introduced myself and then explained, just on a hunch that it would mean something to him, that Will was searching for the Ninth Insight.
I'm familiar with the manuscript, he said. I'm here to study its authenticity.
Alone?
I was to meet a Professor Dobson here, but so far he has not come. I don't understand the delay. He assured me that he would be here when I arrived.
You know Dobson?
Yes. He is the one who is organizing an inspection of the manuscript.
And he's all right? He's coming here?
The professor looked at me questioningly. Those were the plans we made. Has something been wrong? My energy fell. I realized that Dobson's meeting with Connor had been set up before Dobson's arrest. I met him on the airplane, I explained, when I came to Peru. He was arrested in Lima. I have no idea what happened to him.
Arrested? My God!
When did you last speak with him, I asked.
Several weeks ago, but our meeting time here was firm. He said he would call me if anything changed.
Do you remember why he wanted you to meet him here instead of in Lima? I asked. He said there were some ruins around here, and that he would be up in this area speaking with another scientist.
Did he mention where he would be talking to this scientist?
Yes. He said he had to go to, San Luis, I believe. Why?
I don't know. I was just wondering. As I said this, two things happened simultaneously. First, I began thinking of Dobson, of seeing him again. We were meeting along a road with large trees, and then, at the same time, I looked out the window and saw, to my amazement, Father Sanchez walking up the porch steps. He looked tired and his clothes were dirty. In the parking lot, another priest waited in an old car.
"Who is that?" Professor Connor asked.
"It's Father Sanchez," I replied, barely able to contain my excitement. I turned around and looked for Julia, but she was no longer sitting at our table. I got up just as Sanchez walked into the room. When he saw me, he stopped abruptly, a look of total surprise on his face. Then he walked over and embraced me.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
"Yes, fine," I said.
"What are you doing here?"
Through his fatigue, he chuckled lightly.
"I didn't know where else to go, and I almost didn't make it here. Hundreds of troops are headed this way."
"Why are the troops coming?" Connor asked from behind me, walking up to where Sanchez and I were standing.
"I'm sorry," Sanchez replied. "I do not know what the troops have in mind. I just know there are many."
I introduced the two men and told Father Sanchez of Connor's situation. Connor appeared panicked.
"I must leave," he said, "but I have no driver."
"Father Paul is waiting outside," Sanchez said. "He is going back to Lima immediately. You may ride with him if you wish."
"Indeed, I do," Connor said.
"Wait, what if they run into those troops?" I asked.
"I don't think they would stop Father Paul," Sanchez said. "He is not well known."
At that moment, Julia came back into the room and saw Sanchez. The two hugged warmly, and again, I introduced Connor. As I spoke, Connor seemed to grow even more fearful, and after only a few minutes, Sanchez told him that it was time for Father Paul to start back. Connor left to get his belongings from his room and quickly returned. Both Sanchez and Julia escorted him outside. But I told him goodbye there and waited at the table. I wanted to think. I knew meeting Connor was significant somehow, and that Sanchez finding us here was important, but I couldn't quite figure it out. Before long, Julia came back into the room and sat down beside me.
"I told you something was going to happen here," she said. "If we hadn't stopped, we wouldn't have seen Sanchez or Connor, for that matter. By the way, what did you learn from Connor?"
"I'm not sure yet," I said.
"Where's Father Sanchez?"
"He checked into a room to rest for a while. He hasn't slept in 2 days."
I looked away. I knew that Sanchez was tired, but hearing that he was unavailable disappointed me. I wanted very much to talk with him, to see if he could add some perspective to what was happening, especially concerning the soldiers. I felt uneasy, and part of me wanted to flee with Connor. Julia picked up on my impatience.
"Take it easy," she said. "Slow down and tell me what you think of the Eighth Insight so far."
I looked at her and tried to center myself.
"I'm not sure where to start."
"What do you think the Eighth Insight is saying?"
I thought back.
"It's about a way of relating to other people, to children and to adults. It's about naming control dramas and breaking through them and focusing on other people in a way that sends them energy."
"And?" she asked.
I focused on her face and immediately saw what she was getting at.
"And if we are observant about who to talk with, then we get the answers we desire as a result."
Julia smiled broadly.
"Have I grasped the insight?" I asked.
"Almost," she said. "But there's one more thing. You understand how one person can uplift another. Now you're about to see what happens in a group when all of the participants know how to interact this way."
I walked out to the porch and sat in one of the wrought iron chairs. After a few minutes, Julia came through the door and joined me.
We had eaten a leisurely dinner without much talking, and afterward had decided to sit outside in the night air. 3 hours had gone by since Sanchez had gone to his room, and I was beginning to feel impatient again. When Sanchez suddenly walked outside and sat down with us, I was relieved. "Have you heard anything about Will?" I asked him. When I spoke, he slid his chair around to face Julie and me. I noticed that he was carefully adjusting the position of his chair so that he was an equal distance from each of us. "Yes," he said finally, "I have." He paused again and appeared to be in thought, so I asked, "What did you hear?" "Let me tell you everything that happened," he said. "When Father Carl and I left to go back to my mission, we expected to find Father Sebastian there along with the military. We expected an inquisition. When we arrived, we found that Father Sebastian and the soldiers had left abruptly several hours earlier after receiving a message. For a whole day, we didn't know what was going on. Then, yesterday, we were visited by a Father Costu, whom I understand you have met. He told us that he was directed to my mission by Will James. Apparently, Will remembered the name of my mission from his conversation earlier with Father Carl, and intuitively knew that we would need the information Father Costu was bringing. Father Costu has decided to support the manuscript." "Why did Sebastian leave so suddenly?" I asked. "Because," Sanchez said, "he wanted to speed up the implementation of his plans. The message he received told him that Father Costu was about to expose his intention to destroy the Ninth Insight."
"Sebastian found it?"
"Not yet, but he expects to. They found another document that indicated where the Ninth is."
"Where is it supposed to be?" Julia asked.
"At the Celestine Ruins," Sanchez replied.
"Where is that?" I inquired.
Julia looked at me.
"About 60 miles from here. It's a dig the Peruvian scientists have excavated exclusively and with quite a lot of secrecy. It consists of several layers of ancient temples, first Mayan, then Inca. Apparently, both cultures believe there is something special about the location." I suddenly realized that Sanchez was concentrating on the conversation with unusual intensity. When I talked, he would focus totally on me, without breaking his gaze at all. When Julia spoke, Father Sanchez shifted his position to focus completely on her. He seemed to be acting very deliberately. I wondered what he was doing. And at that precise moment, there occurred a lull in the conversation. They both looked at me expectantly.
"What?" I asked. Sanchez smiled. "It's your time to speak."
"Are we taking turns?" I asked.
"No," Julia said.
"We are having a conscious conversation. Each person speaks when the energy moves to him. We could tell it had moved to you."
I didn't know what to say. Sanchez looked at me warmly. "Part of the Eighth Insight is learning to interact consciously when in a group. But don't get self-conscious. Just understand the process. As the members of a group talk, only one will have the most powerful idea at any one point in time. If they are alert, the others in the group can feel who is about to speak, and then they can consciously focus their energy on this person, helping to bring out his idea with the greatest clarity. Then, as the conversation proceeds, someone else will have the most powerful idea, then someone else, and so forth. If you concentrate on what is being said, you can feel when it's your turn. The idea will come up into your mind."
Sanchez shifted his eyes to Julia, who asked, "What idea were you having that you didn't express?"
I tried to think.
"I was wondering," I said finally, "why Father Sanchez was looking intensely at whomever was speaking. I guess I was wondering what it meant."
"The key to this process," Sanchez said, "is to speak up when it is your moment and to project energy when it is someone else's time."
"Many things can go wrong," Julia interjected. "Some people get inflated when in a group. They feel the power of an idea and express it. Then, because that burst of energy feels so good, they keep on talking long after the energy should have shifted to someone else. They try to monopolize the group. Others are pulled back.
and even when they feel the power of an idea, they won't risk saying it. When this happens, the group fragments, and the members don't get the benefit of all the messages. The same thing happens when some members of the group are not accepted by some of the others. The rejected individuals are prevented from receiving the energy, and so the group misses the benefit of their ideas. Julia paused, and we both looked at Sanchez, who was taking a breath to speak. "How people are excluded is important," he said. "When we dislike someone or feel threatened by someone, the natural tendency is to focus on something we dislike about the person, something that irritates us. Unfortunately, when we do this, instead of seeing the deeper beauty of the person and giving them energy, we take energy away and actually do them harm. All they know is that they suddenly feel less beautiful and less confident, and it is because we sapped their energy." "That's why," Julia said, "this process is so important. Humans are aging each other at a tremendous rate out there with their violent competitions."
"But remember," Sanchez added, "in a truly functional group, the idea is to do the opposite of this. The idea is for every member's energy and vibration to increase because of the energy sent by all of the others. When this occurs, everyone's individual energy field merges with everyone else's and makes one pool of energy. It is as if the group is just one body, but one with many heads. Sometimes one head speaks for the body. Sometimes another talks. But in a group functioning this way, each individual knows when to speak and what to say because he truly sees life more clearly. This is the higher person the Eighth Insight talked about in connection with a romantic relationship between a man and a woman. But other groups can form one as well."
Father Sanchez's words made me think of Father Castu suddenly, and of Pablo. Had this young Indian finally changed Father Castu's mind, leading him to now want to preserve the manuscript? Was Pablo able to do this because of the power of the Eighth Insight?
"Where is Father Castu now?" I asked. Both individuals looked mildly surprised at my question, but Father Sanchez quickly replied. "He and Father Carl decided to go to Lima to speak with our church leaders about what Cardinal Sebastian seems to have planned."
"I guess that's why he was so adamant about going to your mission with you. He knew there was something else he was supposed to do."
"Exactly," Sanchez said.
A lull developed in the conversation, and we looked at one another, each of us waiting for the next idea.
"The question now," Father Sanchez finally said, "is what are we supposed to do?"
Julia spoke first. "I've had thoughts all along about being involved with the Ninth Insight somehow, of getting hold of it long enough to do something, but I can't quite see it clearly."
Sanchez and I gazed at her intensely.
"I see this happening at a particular place," she continued. "Wait a minute. The place I've been thinking about is at the ruins, at the Celestine ruins. There is a particular spot there between the temples. I'd almost forgotten." She looked back at us. "That's where I need to go. I need to go to the Celestine ruins."
As Julia finished, both she and Sanchez shifted their gaze to me.
"I don't know," I said. "I've been interested in why Sebastian and his people are so against the manuscript. I found it's because they fear the idea of our inner evolution. But now I don't know where to go. Those soldiers are coming. It appears that Sebastian is going to find the Ninth Insight first. I don't know. I've been thinking I'm involved somehow in convincing him not to destroy it."
I stopped speaking. My thoughts went to Dobson again, and then abruptly to the Ninth Insight. I suddenly realized that the Ninth Insight was going to reveal where we humans were going with this evolution. I had wondered how humans would be acting toward each other as a result of the manuscript, and that question had been answered with the Eighth Insight. And now, the logical next question was, where is it all going to lead? How will human society change? That had to be what the Ninth was about.
I knew somehow that this knowledge could also be used to ease Sebastian's fears about conscious evolution, if he would listen. I still think Cardinal Sebastian can be convinced to support the manuscript, I said with conviction.
You see yourself convincing him? Sanchez asked me.
No. No, not really. I'm with someone else who can reach him, someone who knows him and can speak at his level.
As I said that, Julie and I both spontaneously looked at Father Sanchez. He struggled to smile and spoke with resignation. Cardinal Sebastian and I have avoided a confrontation over the manuscript for a long time. He has always been my superior. He considered me his protege, and I must admit that I looked up to him. But I guess I always knew that it would come to this. The first time you mentioned it, I knew that the task of convincing him was mine. My whole life has set me up for it. He looked intensely at Julia and me, then continued. My mother was a Christian reformer. She hated the use of guilt and coercion when evangelizing. She felt that people should come to religion because of love, not out of fear. My father, on the other hand, was a disciplinarian who later became a priest and, like Sebastian, believed adamantly in tradition and authority. That left me wanting to work within the church authority, but always seeking ways it should be amended so that higher religious experience is emphasized. Dealing with Sebastian is the next step for me. I've been resisting it, but I know I have to go to Sebastian's mission at Iquitos.
I'll ride with you, I said.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 6 of The Celestine Prophecy. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 7.